owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. There's a lot of cool things about being a radio host, one of which is I get to read a lot of books. I mean, a lot of books, probably about one a week. Over the years, I've developed a list of some of my favorite authors, whether they're in the historical or the fiction genre. And today I'm pleased to have one of my favorites back on. I've read four of his five books, and they're all excellent. Not just me, the critics agree. His book Rampage was named Best Book of 2018 by the editors of Amazon, Kirkus, and Military Times, and his book Target Tokyo was a finalist for a 2016 Pulitzer. Last time we talked with James M. Scott, which is way back in February of 2019, I asked him what his next project was, and he said he was working on a book about the firebombing of Tokyo. That product is now off the presses. It's called Black Snow, Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo, and The Road to the Atomic Bomb. Ladies and gentlemen, I consider James M. Scott to be one of the best historical writers of our generation, and we're very, very pleased to have him back. James, good to talk to you again.
Ben, thanks so much for having me back on and for all the great compliments. I really appreciate it, man. You're a dear friend and perform a great service for all of your listeners out there. Thank you.
It's well-deserved. And frankly, you keep writing books, that's one less show I got to plan for.
Right? I'm actually working on another one now.
What,
so, you know, like,
well, tell us what is...
Out. We'll start off.
Yeah, let's start off the first at the beginning of the show, around the end. James, what is in the works there?
Yes, I'm actually working on a book that in a lot of ways is a sequel to Black Snow. You know, Black Snow looks at Curtis LeMay and his decision to firebomb Tokyo in March of 1945. And, you know, that sort of takes us up through to the atomic bombings. And so what I'm actually working on now is a book looking at those 3 days, that critical 72-hour window between August 6th and August 9th, when America literally obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it's going to be a granular level look, you know, from the American, the Japanese perspectives at that tight window. Another good upbeat topic.
Well, yeah, let's lighten people's day. But I'm curious about the evolution of your writing, because your last book, Rampage, which was excellent, about the battle for Manila, the first book of yours that I read was Target Tokyo, about the Doolittle Raid. And then we proceed through the history of the war in the Pacific. Rampage talks about Manila and just what a meat grinder that was. And then in your latest book, Black Snow, I see references to that where the U.S. military planners are thinking, well, you know, Manila gave us a preview of just how awful it's going to be if we do have to land troops on the Japanese homeland and do that sort of urban house-to-house fighting. So do you...
Yeah.
Are you sequencing your books, or are you kind of thinking on parallel tracks all the same time?
You know, probably more the latter. I mean, I'll tell you, so I wrote Target Tokyo, which I just absolutely love that story. You know, that's looking at America's first effort to sort of strike Japan with the Army Air Forces. And so with Black Snow, I kind of wanted to come back and sort of write what I felt like was the sequel to that book in a lot of ways. And so, you know, there was a gap in between it when I looked at Rampage. Rampage did very much help educate me, and I think also kind of get, you know, bring me up to the story perspective, because literally the Battle of Manila takes place about a week before, you know, wraps up really about a week before the firebombing of Tokyo. But this book in a lot of ways is kind of an outgrowth of Target Tokyo, much like my next book is going to be sort of an outgrowth of this. So I kind of do visualize that the three books, you know, on the air campaign will kind of be almost like an unofficial trilogy, kind of charting America's development of air strategy against the Empire of Japan.
Now, James, there's a number of interesting characters that have come out of World War II, and several of them play parts in your latest book or in this action. But one guy I'd never heard of before is General Hansel. And he's just not much of a career, I guess, or I mean, are we being dismissed there and the Pacific was kind of the end of any fast rise for him, or?
It was. Yeah. And Hansel is a fascinating character. You know, his success has really almost come before the war, really. I mean, he is one of those guys who, you know, aviation is really a new form of a new player on the battlefield by the time World War II comes around. You know, it makes a sort of a debut in World War One, but it's really about World War Two where the technology's caught up enough where you have these, you know, these muscular four-engine bombers that are capable of bridging oceans and turning entire nations into battlefields. But that pivotal period between World War One and World War Two is when you see the rise of American intellectuals, guys like Haywood Hansel, who are trying to figure out how best can we employ this new weapon in a battlefield scenario. And so that's kind of where Hansel's strength is. He actually helps develop the entire air war plan that America uses against Germany. And, of course, that is built around this idea of high-altitude, daylight precision bombing, which is seen to be more humane than sort of firebombing cities like what the British ultimately did. But, of course, you know, the rubber meets the road when the war breaks out and they realize that, you know, there are, you know, the German economy is far more resourceful than they thought. You know, the hope had been that if you target a handful of industries, you could kind of collapse their economy like a house of cards. Of course, it doesn't really work out. The Germans are able to disperse industry. They're able to grab raw materials from occupied countries. And, of course, that air war really kind of drags on and on. Hansel's been sort of given a second bite at the apple in late 44 when he's sent to be the top prosecutor of the air war against Japan. And that's where he really struggles a lot because he's not a combat commander. You know, he's a planner. He's not a predator. And there on in the Mariana Islands, you know, he's forced into this role of being the guy who's running this air campaign. And it really reveals a lot of his weaknesses. And so he's ultimately fired. And it's a crushing blow for him. I mean, he had been chief of staff to General Hap Arnold, who of course runs the entire air service. You know, it felt like he had a good relationship with him, and he's only given literally 44 days to run these operations before Arnold pulls the plug on him. And that, of course, makes way for Curtis LeMay to come in.
And Curtis LeMay is truly one of the more interesting cats of World War II. He kind of reminds me of a sort of a George S. Patton attitude, but with a pilot's license. You know,
and not as verbose.
Right. Well, right. Now, one thing I didn't know about him until I read your book, James, is he, you know, he's famous for, you know, kind of the cigar chomping general, but that was because he actually had a health condition that he used
exactly.
That to sort of cover that up.
Exactly. So LeMay develops Bell's palsy in the beginning of the war, which is a form of facial paralysis, and it causes his right cheek to droop. And it causes, like, you know, his eyes to water and things like that. He has some headaches. But he decides that he's going to hide that by chewing on a cigar. And that cigar really becomes this indelible image of Curtis LeMay. In fact, he later in the war appears on Time magazine with that cigar clenched between his teeth. But LeMay is a really fascinating character. You know, so often we think of LeMay from his post-World War II career when he's, you know, chief of staff for the Air Force, when he clashes with Kennedy and McNamara, and then, of course, his ill-fated run with George Wallace for president and vice president. But LeMay's shining moment really is during World War II, and he's truly one of America's top combat commanders. And he pioneers, you know, longer bomb runs and better formations in Europe. He's promoted over to the Pacific War, where he helps bring about the demise of the Empire of Japan and whatnot. So his shining parts of his career, I mean, he's really those few years during World War II.
And he saw a great deal of success and changed a lot of the strategies in Europe. And he did. He had a civil engineering degree that he worked very hard for. But I know in your book it relates how they were having trouble hitting the targets in Europe and because they were dodging flak. And so night he sits down with a napkin maybe and a pencil and just does the math and figures out, no, you need to do a straight and level bomb run on the last run of the bomb run. And by the way, statistically, the flak's not going to get you. And that worked.
And he's exactly right. And see, and that's what LeMay is. He's a problem solver. And see, he'd grown up dirt poor in Ohio, and he'd learned, you know, his father sort of bounced the family all around the country. He went from sort of one, you know, manual labor job to the next. And so LeMay had learned at a very early age that he could really only depend on himself. In fact, he put himself to Ohio State working all night in a steel mill. I mean, so he just had this tenacious work ethic, this engineering problem solver's mindset, and just a dogged desire to accomplish results. And you're absolutely right. He applies that engineer, that problem solver's perspective to the air war in Europe with great success because for so many of these airmen, this is their first time in combat. They have no idea that, you know, German flak is not as accurate as they think it is and whatnot. And so he applies, you know, his math skills and his engineering background to kind of dispel the myth of German flak. And as a result of that, their successes go way up.
Yeah.
And so he not only gains the respect of his superiors, but his own airmen are, you know, realize, hey, this guy's somebody to follow. And one of my favorite quotes actually is one of his airmen said, look, if LeMay told me 2 + 2 = 5, I'd believe him.
But I tell you, he led from the front, too. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, James, and then wrap up our discussion about the players and then talk about the plane. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with James M. Scott. You can learn more, visit jamesmscottwith2t's.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, chatting with one of my favorite authors of all time, James M. Scott. His latest release is a story of the background and the prosecution of the firebombing of Tokyo. It's called Black Snow. You can find that at jamesmscott.com or wherever you get your favorite books. James, we're talking a little bit about the key player in this story, Curtis LeMay. And part of the reason, I mean, he trained his men hard. I mean, he was a soldier's general. And I read a passage somewhere where he, in Europe, they're having so many of the B-17s turn around and abort the missions. And he decided, he's like, look, I'm going to fly in the lead plane on these missions. And any son of a gun who drops out of formation and returns to base is going to be court-martialed. And voila, the number of aborts went down.
Yeah, no, LeMay was a big believer that if he was going to send men into combat, he needed to be willing to go with them, and he did. In fact, he led some of the most dangerous missions, including the Regensburg-Schweinfurt mission, which was just a grueling attack on Germany's ball-bearing plants. I mean, over the course of a couple of raids, we lost like 60 bombers, and LeMay flew that mission. So, and he was a really good, I mean, he was a really great navigator. He's, you know, before the war leading up, I mean, he'd been a long-time pilot. He'd initially been a fighter pilot, and he'd moved over. He recognized that future warfare was going to come down to bombardment, so he switched over to bombing platforms. And so he was very much an airman's commander. I mean, he wasn't going to send people out there to do something that he wasn't willing to get in the plane and do himself.
Well, and you also say he was very pragmatic about the execution of war, and one of the quotes that jumped out at me is, and he's talked about, you know, there's no shortcut to victory when he's in the Pacific, and he says, you've got to kill people, and when you kill enough of them, then they stop fighting. Pretty brutal words, but...
It's true. I mean, it really is. So many conflicts come down to, just, you know, a game of ratios and numbers, and LeMay saw it that way. You know, you've just got to wear them down. And he didn't sugarcoat things. I mean, and he was a pragmatic guy. He was impolite in some circles, you might say. But he leveled with people. And he told them, you know, the reality of stuff.
I tell you, one of my favorite
what you want.
One of my favorite stories in your book was right after he arrived, and I think it was the Marianas, and all these Navy admirals are inviting him over to dinner at their, you know, estates, and they've got butlers, and they're, you know, having roasted pig and, you know, duck and all this fancy stuff, and he's looking around, so he decided he would invite them over. To host him at his encampment and basically served him what his airmen were eating, which was, you know, sea rations. And I think that got the message across.
Exactly. It did, because, you know, I mean, the air service is always kind of sort of the stepchild of the Army and the Navy, is, you know, they're always kind of sort of, because at that point they're not independent. You know, they are part of the Army. Mm-hmm. They're trying to assert their independence. They've got this weapon that is designed as an independent fighting platform, and yet they're at the mercy of the Navy to sort of bring them things and sort of develop their bases. And that was exactly what LeMay was trying to send them a message. I mean, you guys are eating well, and you've got tennis courts for your commanders, and I'm still living in a tent and eating flight rations. So get on the ball. Help us, you know, do what we need to do to win this war.
Build more airstrips and less tennis courts. Let's talk about the weapon. It was pretty clear for anybody who could read a map that bombing in Europe is one thing. You know, the distances you don't have to cover as long of a distance. If something goes wrong, I mean, you don't want to be a POW, but at least you're bailing out over land. And even if you went down to the channel, rescue was pretty close, but whole different story in the Pacific. And that's where somebody said, look, we need something that's got more capability to cover longer distances, to carry a larger payload, and that's how the B-29 Stratofortress came to be, the most expensive project of the entire war.
Yeah, I mean, really, geography is almost an enemy to the American airmen in the Pacific as much as the Japanese are. And by that, it's, you know, it's a 3,000-mile round-trip mission from the Mariana Islands to Tokyo and back. And if you catch battle flak or fighter damage, there's nowhere to put down. I mean, you're looking down at a cold, hostile, dark waters. And so, and the B-29 is the only plane that America has in its arsenal that's capable of bridging that distance. And it really is, they called it Hap Arnold's gamble because, I mean, it really was. It was $3.7 billion, which, you know, in the 1940s is a tremendous amount of money. Cost more than the atomic bomb to design and develop. And it's really the most sophisticated, complex weapon that we have at that time. I mean, it's capable of flying 4,000 miles. It's got pressurized cabins that air crews can operate in their T-shirts. You know, it's built out of 55,000 parts. It's got a tail the height of a three-story building, a wingspan that's longer than the Wright brothers' first flight. I mean, it really is just an aeronautical monster. And, of course, it's put into combat without any real heavy testing. And so, you know, unlike the B-17, which, of course, was developed, you know, in the 1930s, and there's a lot of time to sort of work out kinks before they start flying those in heavy rotation over Europe, the B-29 rolls out of the factory and goes straight into combat. So very quickly they learned, you know, something that's sophisticated is going to have problems. And it's, these aren't the kind of missions you want to have problems on.
Well, and two other things that I, you know, consider the time were very advanced. One, they had radar tracking capability, and literally computer controlled remote guns, which seems very bizarre in the 40s, but they were there.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that. I mean, your cell phone has more computing power than those guns did. So, I mean, this was pretty, you know, any computer system during that time period is pretty primitive, but it got the job done, no doubt about it. But so one of the biggest problems they had is that the engines on these planes caught on fire. And so on these long missions at high altitudes, you're putting tremendous strain on these engines. And so that became a huge problem, and they had to sort of figure out a way to kind of work around it. And so, I mean, early on, I mean, I think what May would tell you, they probably lost more planes to mechanical issues than to enemy action. But eventually they did get that sorted out. But that's the reality of when you literally take a plane straight off the drawing board and put it right into combat. There's no time to really work out those kinks.
James, you mentioned geography. That was initially that we were, you know, back in those days, most of China were our allies, but to try and bomb Japan from China was just a logistical nightmare. One, you had to get over the hump, fly over the, as they call it, the hump, and then just keeping the aircraft supplied and maintained, that was a nightmare in and of itself. Do you, from your research, do you know the invasion of the Marianas Islands, was that specifically to try and find an air base, a runway closer to Japanese homeland, or just it turned out that way?
No, it's absolutely. I mean, the Mariana Islands were taken specifically to give America those air bases. I mean, and it put the Mariana Islands really put Japan for the first time within range, you know, their dominant industrial cities within range of American bombers. And the Japanese knew that. In fact, you know, Hirohito's senior naval admiral told Hirohito when the Marianas fell, he said, "Hell is upon us." And he was right, because at that point we were inside their defensive perimeter. You know, we could put bombers over their skies night after night if we wanted to, and really bring to them the hell and the fury that the Germans had suffered. And, of course, it takes us a little while to get there. You know, don't have a lot of airplanes. We've got kinks in these airplanes. We're sort of figuring out how to fight them. But eventually, that's exactly what happens to Japan cities.
Well, and considering that his predecessor was basically fired, Curtis LeMay's got it. He's working under a ticking clock as well.
He absolutely is. I mean, Hansel is fired. He literally flies operations for just 44 days before Arnold says, you know what, it's not working out. You're gone. They bring in LeMay. Hansel at least had a long personal relationship with Arnold, and despite that, Arnold had still fired him. So LeMay had only met Arnold one time. So he had no personal loyalties, you know, Arnold did for LeMay. So LeMay knew he was going to be given a really short leash in which he could either make it work or he, too, was going to be fired. And so he begins January 1945, initially trying to make daylight high-altitude precision bombing work. he starts tinkering with what Hansel had done. You know, he brings the bombers down a little bit to get under the cloud cover. He improves the maintenance for the bombers, and he does things like that. But he ultimately comes to realize that the way in which America is attacking Japan simply is not a fixable an equation there, that there's just – he's going to have a radical rethinking of how we're going to attack the enemy if we're going to be successful.
And Jason, when we come back, I'd like to explain a couple of those reasons because I found that very fascinating. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bueller Garcia talking with James Scott. His latest book is called Black Snow. You can find out more at jamesmscott.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with author James M. Scott. He's a great writer. His latest book is called Black Snow, Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo and the Road to the Atomic Bomb. James, we were talking about the challenge that was plunked in Curtis LeMay's lap to prosecute the war against Japan in the Pacific. And he had experience doing bombing runs and developing strategy in Europe. But even with this brand new shiny plane, it became evident that that was not going to work for a couple of reasons, including the weather, cloud cover, which is much different in the Pacific than it is in Europe. And then there's this thing called the jet stream. And I mean, even anyone who kind of slept through, a geometry class knows that something like that, when you're dropping from 20,000 feet, a little change in something like a jet stream can blow your bombs way off target. I mean, you're not... forget about putting them in a pickle barrel. You're not putting them in the same county.
Exactly. No, those are really the two main issues confronting American bombardiers at that point, which is heavy cloud cover. And if you're trying to do high altitude daylight precision bombing, you need to see what you're aiming at. And in Japan had some days, some months in which there was literally about 3 days of clear weather a month. And so that just, of course, is an impossibility. And then on top of that, you're right, the jet streams, which nobody at that point really knew much about. But they were blowing it at speeds of 230 miles per hour, and they're just wrecking bomber accuracy. So those two elements really combined to just completely stymie America's ability to get bombs on target and force LeMay to make his big change.
One of the things I like about your books, James, is they're very well researched, and you present both perspectives in every one of the cases that you presented in your books. And I'm just kind of curious about, you got to wonder, what on earth were the Japanese thinking? As I understand, by that time, our submarine forces had already severely limited their supplies, the materials, the critical war materials they needed. Their Navy pretty much was out of the picture by then, but only one very few voices in Japan were arguing for not continuing the war. Did you get a sense of why that was?
Yeah, Japan was really, and it's important to remember too, I mean, as a result of a handful of their leaders, their emperor and sort of the senior military leaders around them, their people suffered tremendously because the submarine blockade really cuts off the importation of all the vital things, including food, okay? So by the last year of the war, I mean, people are they're malnourished. You have new mothers, are so malnourished they can't even produce milk. The average person spending hours every day just trying to secure enough food for themselves and their families. So it's a real struggle, and the submarine blockade does a lot for that. But of course, Hirohito and his senior leaders are kind of shielded from that, and they're desperately trying to have one more victory because they're convinced that one more victory will give them a better seat at the negotiating table for surrender. Because they want to be able to they don't want to have to do unconditional surrender. They want to be able to bargain. What they want to bargain for is that they can keep the imperial, the emperor on the throne there. And so it's really a pretty selfish act that they're fighting and putting their people through this much suffering just basically to be able for the emperor to keep his job.
Do you think apart from the logistics, that also was a factor in moving towards the nighttime fire bombings, because given what we saw in Manila and given this fanaticism and loyalty to the emperor, our leadership said, we can't just beat them militarily. We've got to break their spirit completely.
Yeah, you've got to eradicate that seed of authoritarianism and end it. And so, but also a big thing that really hung over the air service was that if they could break Japan, if they could bring Japan to its knees before an invasion, they could save hundreds of thousands of American lives. And that's a big part of what they're trying to do. If they can bomb Japan into submission, Americans will live. And that's the goal that's really hanging over LeMay, which kind of, they can continue bombing at high altitudes and doing it, whatnot, and, and limp along, and eventually Japan will probably collapse or whatnot. But the longer they drag this out, the greater the likelihood is that there's going to be a big invasion and that Americans are going to have to do battle inside their cities. And it's going to be like Manila all over again. And that's what they're trying to prevent. They have to break Japan and break it quickly.
He was looking at some of the data, and in 2037 sorties, they'd failed to completely destroy a single target. And the Navy is now starting to beat him to the punch. I mean, they're sending in their smaller, faster planes, and they're actually hitting targets. So LeMay's like, I'm looking at getting, not only looking at getting fired, but he's not the kind of guy that takes failure very well or doesn't put up with it. So he comes up with this new strategy. Well, not really a new strategy, but he decided that was the way to go. And I found it, tell our listeners real quick, we've got about 5 minutes for our next break, but I found the way he actually moved this forward really interesting. It was an elaborate plan, a lot of moving parts, but he kind of sort of stuck it by his higher-ups.
He totally did. LeMay doesn't tell anybody in Washington what he's about to do, and it's a radical rethinking of American bombing strategy. We thought this whole war we've been flying missions way up high during the daylight, aiming at precision targets. And LeMay says, this isn't working, so I'm going to bring the planes from 30,000 feet to 5,000 feet. I'm going to push these attacks from day to night. I'm going to swap out demolition bombs for incendiary bombs, and I'm going to burn Japan's cities to the ground. And it's an incredible, reimagining of how to go about this attack. But LeMay doesn't run it up the ladder, and in part because he's like, if this mission is failed, and a lot of people on his staff, including his artillery officers, thought it might, he wanted Hap Arnold and his superiors to be able to have deniability. Mm-hmm. So that way they could say, it was Curtis LeMay's fault. We fired him, moved on, and they could salvage the B-29 plan and continue bombing. And so it's one of the most consequential decisions of the war, and it's made by a 38-year-old field commander.
And the way he did it, too, because at that time, now Hap Arnold had, what, 4 or 5 heart attacks during the course of the war?
He had his 4th in January of 45. So
he's in a hospital, so he's not in a position to make a decision anyway. And LeMay is kind of funny. He just asked a veiled question to Arnold's second in command and said, do you think he would go for a gamble? And the guy said, yeah, as long as it ends the war, without giving him any details. And so LeMay's like, okay, that's the green light. I'm good to go.
That's exactly what he does. And that's what I'm saying. That's what makes it such an incredible story, because Arnold's chief of staff, LeMay doesn't really trust him because he thinks he's gunning for his job. And so he doesn't want to let the cat out of the bag any more than he has to. And so he cryptically asked him, is Arnold a gambler? That's all it takes.
Now, what's other I love about your book, too, as I mentioned, LeMay works his crews pretty hard, both the maintenance crews and the flight crews, but they may not love him, but they've got respect for him. But I'm trying to imagine what it was like when they go into that briefing room and it's laid out for them.
That respect they had for him at least was rattled that night for sure, because, a lot of those guys really thought it was a suicide mission. If you're bringing these bombers down from, 30,000 feet to 5,000 feet, and you're sending them into one of the most heavily defended cities on the world, and not only that, you're going to take the guns off of them and take the ammunition and even the gunners out. You're sending them in defenseless. But LeMay kind of calculated that Japan was so used to America bombing during the day and at high altitudes that they would never anticipate a low-altitude nighttime strike, and that this would effectively be an aerial sucker punch. And he was exactly right.
When the Japanese did not really have much, if any, night fighter capability, did they?
No, they did not. And LeMay, he took advantage. He said, look, if we hit Tokyo, we're successful. We're going to hit Nagoya, Osaka, Kobe. We're going to hit boom, 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 boom before they can really get up off the mat. we're going to pound their big cities and take advantage of the surprise element.
I find it interesting that, like you said, America made a conscious decision in Europe not to use precision bombing to try and mitigate civilian casualties as much as possible. And this Tokyo raid is really taking place in context with the Dresden raid, which was just horrible.
A few weeks earlier.
Right. And yeah. So back in Washington, they're working on that, you know, plausible deniability. That's not official U.S., you know, DOD policy. And meanwhile, in the Pacific, Curtis LeMay is like, over here, it's got to be.
Yeah, and that's LeMay's just kind of oblivious to those arguments back in the States. I mean, he's out there. His job is to put bombs on target and bring Japan to its knees. He doesn't care about the politics of it. He's going to leave that to the bureaucrats in the Pentagon. And so Dresden does take place literally just 3 weeks earlier. LeMay's strike on Tokyo is actually four times as destructive. I mean, he wipes out 16 square miles of the capital and kills over 100,000 people. I mean, Dresden only kills about 25,000 to 35,000 people. So, I mean, it's literally – he quadruples the fatalities. But he's – LeMay doesn't really concern himself with the public backlash that might come from this. I mean, he really – he's tunnel visioned for being successful with his job and leaves the rest of that to the folks in Washington.
And I kind of in the back of my head, James, I get an echo of George S. Patton again, where I can't remember, I'll get the quote wrong, but, you know, I'm not asking you to die for your country. I'm telling you to make the other guy die for his country.
Make the other guy die. Exactly.
So, I tell you,
James, that is exactly it.
When we come back, I want to talk about the actual mission and the aftermath. And then of course the next steps, once that threshold had been crossed, the next steps to the atomic bomb. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with James M. Scott. Learn more at jamesmscott.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American War Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with author James M. Scott. You can learn more at jamesmscott.com. His latest book is called Black Snow, Curtis LeMay, The Firebombing of Tokyo and the Road to the Atomic Bomb. And I really mean this, James. I really highly endorse your books. They're all very carefully researched and very well written. Let's come back to the bombing itself. You mentioned it incinerated 15.8 square miles of Tokyo, 267,171 homes, stores, and businesses burned. And just the intensity of the fire, not only because the way most of these cities and homes were constructed, mostly out of wood and bamboo and paper, but also the winds that came through the area picked this up, and it was so intense. In your book, you write about how some of these bombers actually returned to their base, and the paint on the bottom of the aircraft was singed, and they're thousands of feet in the air.
Oh, yeah. No, a lot of them came back, and the bellies were just stained black with soot from the city. You know, as they're burning and whatnot, their bomb bay doors are open. You know, it's sort of pulling in these fumes from Tokyo, and so they can smell what it's like in that city. And that includes, you know, not just the burning of documents and houses and all that, but even sort of that greasy smell of barbecued meat. And that's the horses, the dogs, and the people in Tokyo. And as one of the pilots said, it, quote, it was the smell of death. And so they knew it. They knew what they were doing.
I've often wondered, I mean, after experiencing that, how many of those guys thought about, I don't want to fly that mission ever again. But LeMay wanted to keep punching.
Yeah, he did. And I think in the early part, you know, these guys really took off of that mission not thinking they were going to make it home. And I think that self-preservation was the dominant feeling for those early missions. Now, later in the campaign, as the war is really winding down and as, you know, Japan's defenses are really pretty much destroyed, some of those airmen do start kind of wrestling with some of those moral qualms and whatnot. And, you know, in oral histories I read and interviews and some of the letters I saw, you know, I mean, those questions are definitely there for them. But early on at this time, they're more concerned. I mean, they really think they're not coming back from this mission.
As this may or may not be a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, James, as a historian doing all this research, what is your opinion? Do you think the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was necessary?
Well, here's the thing. In the U.S. was really – the U.S. was stunned after the firebombing of Tokyo that Japan didn't surrender. I mean, here was this – I mean, General Marshall was like, we were stunned. You know, here's this massive destruction of their capital, and yet they continue to fight on. Not only did they fight on after Tokyo, but LeMay goes on to destroy 66 of their cities, burns 178 square miles. and yet Japan continues to fight. And so the atomic bomb really becomes in a lot of ways like a Hail Mary for the Americans and also for the Japanese, because at this point the Japanese really realize they need a face-saving way out of this war, something that they can point to. And that's, if you look at the surrender speech that Emperor Hirohito reads to his people on August 15th, he blames the atomic bomb in its totality for Japan's decision to surrender. And so they used the atomic bomb as sort of that way, face-saving way out of the war. But I will tell you this, after Hiroshima, for 48 hours, Japan, of course, doesn't surrender, you know, and then the next day on the 9th, you see the atomic attack on Nagasaki. The Americans were really sweating it out because they're like, we've done everything we can do at this point. We've firebombed their cities. We've used an atomic bomb. We only have one of these bombs left, and yet Japan still hasn't surrendered. So there was a lot of apprehension there until we got word that Japan, you know, in fact, planned to surrender after Nagasaki.
You know, one of the nice things about being a historian or radio host is we have the benefit of hindsight. And I've often wondered if at that point, maybe if someone was talking about, you know what, we got them blocked in, they're no longer a threat, let's just throw a blockade around the island and just end it.
We were already blockading the island. That's important to remember. I mean, our submarine blockade had been, you know, highly successful. I mean, Japan's economy by the summer of 1944 really crosses that apex and begins what amounts to a death spiral. You know, on top of that, B-29s were dropping mines all around Japan and Japanese ports. So, I mean, Japan was definitely feeling the squeeze of a blockade. And we certainly could have drawn that out farther and farther. But, I mean, how long – I mean, how long would that have taken? 1946, 1947? I mean, the Japanese were highly resourceful. They had demonstrated they were willing to live off of, you know, eating acorns and things like that. And meanwhile, you know, people are dying all over Asia, you know, at a rate of about 100,000 people a month. And so, you know, I think the Americans kind of took the approach, which is we just have to rip the Band-Aid off. It's going to hurt. It's going to be violent. But it's better to get it over with quickly.
I'm glad you brought up the harbor mining missions, because that's fascinating as well. I hadn't read much about that, but that was also one of LeMay's ideas, wasn't it?
No, LeMay is basically told he's going to do that. He kind of begrudgingly does it, but he ultimately sees that, hey, this is highly successful. And it was, because, I mean, the submarine blockade had really done a terrific job sort of bottling up Japanese shipping. And what we did is we came in and we parachuted a bunch of mines into the few waters that they were still utilizing. And just, you know, the 1-2 punch of submarines and mines just really completely crippled their whole merchant fleet.
The political ramifications back on the home front, I mean, we're still, unless I missed a big chapter of our history, we're still the only country to ever employ these types of weapons by, I mean, you know, atomic weapons and nuclear weapons in war.
We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, don't even say that. But do you... How long, I mean, I'm guessing shortly thereafter, there's just relief that Japan surrendered and the war was over and our men and women would be coming home. But how long did that warm and fuzzy last before people really started examining the genie that we'd let out of the bottle?
You know, I think, you know, coming out of the end of World War II, there's incredible fatigue, you know, and it's come out, you know, Germany's finally knocked out of the war in May. Japan gets knocked out in late August. Officially surrenders in September, you know, they're, and it also takes us a little while to kind of get into Hiroshima to judge what happened. There's also heavy censorship on a lot of that, what kind of information is getting out. So it's not like that sort of questioning the morality and the ethics of the atomic weapon doesn't happen right away. You know, John Hershey kind of breaks that sort of, you know, stranglehold of when he gets his thing in 1946 in the New Yorker in the book Hiroshima, and then you see more of it coming out after that. But throughout the whole occupation, you know, America tried to kind of keep a bit of a lid, you know, or at least kind of monitor what kind of stuff was being reported on that. So,
you know, one of the greatest ironies, I didn't realize this, but eventually somebody in Japan gave Curtis LeMay an award.
They did, and see, that's the thing. LeMay actually later helped Japan build its Civil Aviation Defense Service. And so in the 1960s, Japan decided they were going to recognize LeMay. And of course, it did create this huge fight in Japanese parliament at the time, because people were like, why would we ever give an award to the guy that destroyed Tokyo and all these other cities? But the prime minister at the time, he said, and he was quoted actually in American media saying this, he said, bygones are bygones.
I tell you, I love your books, James, and I can't wait to see the next one. One thing that always amazed me, you know, you talk about Curtis LeMann's other folks in his generation. I mean, they went from Charles Lindbergh to the lunar landings.
And it did, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, and if you, our generations, if we stop and think about that, I mean, maybe there's lots of change, but it's not as visible. And it's just that generation that went through the Depression and how much that formed their stick-to-itiveness and just their grit in prosecuting the Second World War, I think is something that I always admire.
I mean, think about this. Hap Arnold learned how to fly from the Wright brothers.
Wow.
You know? I mean, in his lifetime, he goes from flying in an Ohio cow pasture with the Wright brothers to commanding the largest global strike force the world's ever seen at that point in the span of like 30 years.
Well,
that's crazy, isn't it?
I'm going to say you better pick up the speed there, James. I expect maybe two more books coming out next.
Yeah. You and me both, man. I wish I could do it that fast.
All right. Well, thank you for spending time with our listeners today, sir. And folks, again, you can visit jamesmscott.com, learn more about what has done and what he's got coming up. You be safe out there, James.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can find over 500 podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can also find it on your favorite streaming platform, whatever you use. And listen, if you support us, visit www.patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. You can kick a little money into the kitty to help us out. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
Listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 300 episodes of this program via AmericanWarriorRadio.com or the most recent episodes via your favorite podcast app.